You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Emily Newitz is the author of nonfiction, including Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction, Four Lost Cities, A Secret History of the Urban Age, The Terraformers, The Future of Another Timeline, and Autonomous. Their new book is Stories Are Weapons. Thank you for joining me, Annalee.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Early in this book, you introduce us to Paul Leinbarger, who wrote science fiction under the name Cordwainer Smith. Talk about how he became central to the idea of psychological warfare.
Frederick Pohl was a major science fiction editor in the 50s and 60s, and he found a Cordwainer Smith story in a very little read anthology that was called Scanners Live in Vain. And he put that story into an anthology that was seen by lots of people. And it kind of was what allowed Cordwainer Smith to break out in the sci-fi world. But of course, Paul Leinbarger, which was his birth name, had been working for a long time as a writer, both of fiction under other pen names, but also as a crafter of psychological weapons during World War II and leading up to it. He was an expert in Chinese language and German language, and he had studied a lot as a kid in China. His father was a diplomat and a lawyer who worked with Sun Yat-sen. And so Leinbarger kind of grew up in many worlds. You know, he grew up partly in East Asia, he grew up partly in the States and partly in Europe. And so I think that experience and working with political operatives gave him the sense that his storytelling powers could be put to excellent use if he were to work with the military and to work with intelligence to persuade our adversaries to come over to the American side of things. And also his deep appreciation for and deep relationship with Sun Yat-sen really instilled in him a kind of moral anti-communism. He was virulently anti-communist, but in a very different way from most Americans during the Cold War, because he was coming at it from the perspective of someone who had loved China before it became a communist country. And he felt that the communists had torn away this beautiful place that he really idealized. And so he was in it in a very different way than many people. And I think that, again, gave him a really different perspective on how to create psyops. And so after World War II, he wrote one of the first guides to psychological warfare for the U.S. Army based on his experiences working with the Army during World War II. And it was a book that continued to be used. It was used by psychological operatives in Vietnam, we know for sure. And it's still taught sometimes in classes on psyops for the Army. So he had this really fascinating career where he kind of bridged storytelling in pop culture with storytelling for propaganda purposes.
One of his most successful operations had to do with a theme of many lots of science fiction, which was atomic warfare.
Yeah, one of his stories that I think is so interesting is called Mother Hitton's Little Kittens, and it's sort of spelled in a strange way, partly because the title is also a password, and so the fact that it's misspelled allows people to kind of track anyone who's using that specific string of letters. So anyway, if you find it, you'll see that Mother Hitton's Little Kittens is spelled oddly. But it's essentially a story about the atomic bomb. But it's about a super weapon that's being used to protect this future Earth power called Norstrilia, which is kind of like an amalgam of Australia and China and a lot of Southeast Asia has kind of come together to form this super culture. And the weapon is a psychological weapon, but it's of the magnitude of an atomic bomb. And they build this weapon by these future humans. They train a bunch of weasels and breed weasels to be the most cruel, angry, aggressive creatures ever seen by humanity or any other non-human animal as well. And so there's like generations of this evil weasel breeding program. And then they finally get enough weasels that are so aggressive and cruel that they basically have to be sedated all the time. But when there's a threat, what happens is the Norstrilians wake all the weasels up, attach their heads to some kind of like brain amplifying device, and all of their thoughts, their angry weasel thoughts, are concentrated into a beam and beamed at the enemy. And in this case, in the story, it's a guy who's coming to steal some valuable stuff that they that the Norstrilians have. And they beam this into his mind to protect themselves. And he eats himself. He is so demoralized, so filled with violence and rage that he eats himself to death in his spaceship before crashing. And so the threat is eliminated through this massive psychological weapon. And one of the things I talk about in Stories Are Weapons in my book is how Paul Linebarger was kind of thinking about how could you create some form of propaganda or messaging, some kind of psychological message that could be as powerful as a bomb. And so this is his fantastical answer to that question. You would breed weasels and amplify their thoughts and cause your enemy to destroy himself before he even gets to your borders, right? And that is kind of a metaphor for what psychological war is supposed to do. It's supposed to prevent the need for a destructive total weapon like an atomic bomb by persuading your adversary that their cause is wasted, that there's no hope for them. It's to demoralize the enemy, you know, to literally make them, well, to figuratively make them kind of consume themselves, turn back on themselves, or to in another scenario, persuade them to come over to your side and to see things from your point of view. And so, of course, that's not the case in Mother Hittin's Little Kittens. It's just all about like the most radical form of demoralization you could ever possibly deliver to anyone. So he, you know, in his fiction, Paul Linebarger thought a lot about sort of metaphors for psychological war and what it would do and how it could protect us. And then in his real life work, I shouldn't say his real life work, but in his military work, he advised, you know, people who were working in psychological operations on how to craft messages that would say, for example, persuade the Japanese to surrender in World War II. He talks a lot about that in his work. Or how to persuade communist powers that actually the American capitalist way is better. And he really felt that pop culture was a big part of that. He said in his work that, you know, America would do better to persuade its adversaries using Laurel and Hardy movies than using like propaganda about like farming and like square-jawed men teaching you to be a good American. That really it was our storytelling, our entertainment that made us such a persuasive power.
I always thought that had we carpet bombed Russia with copies of E.T.
Yeah.
Could have done more good than any kind of bombs. One of the things that you write is that Linebarger spent much of his research time listening to the radio. And this was at a time when radio was had many similarities to the internet today, where you couldn't easily tell who was a professional and who was just an amateur yakking through the ham radio. Talk about his, you know, use of the radio, and also too about how the radio is an easy place for people to create the fog of war, which is a concept I think that's central to this book.
Yeah, it's such an interesting part of his work, because he really was concerned with how people could manipulate mass media, and at the time radio was almost like social media, in order to get messages across. And so he talks a lot about how the Germans used radio during World War II and created what he referred to as falsified stations. So stations that were German in origin, but masqueraded as the BBC, for example. And there was a big celebrity propagandist that the Germans had who went by the name Lord Haw Haw. In reality, he was a British fascist named William Joyce, who defected to Germany because he wanted to, you know, fight on the side of fascists. He had been a fascist his whole life. He was very interested in eliminating Jews. And so he took on this plummy accent and would do these radio broadcasts as Lord Haw Haw that were very funny, and that also gave a lot of information to people listening that was being suppressed by the British. And so it was a kind of uncensored look at some of the troop movements during the war, some of the things that people weren't hearing about in England. And then, of course, mixed in with all kinds of propaganda and misinformation and disinformation. So, and of course, the British created their own versions of this. I'm just reading Peter Pomerantsev's new book, How to Win an Information War, which is the story of a guy who worked with British intelligence creating radio stations with fake German broadcasters who became very popular in Germany, doing the same thing, you know, giving information to German people that was being suppressed by the Nazi party, but also just like making fun of the Nazis and like making fun of their lavish lifestyles and kind of criticizing the Nazis seemingly from within. But of course it was being broadcast from like somewhere in the British countryside. So there was a lot of what we would now call misinformation. We would call it now misinformation online, you know, people pretending to be people that they weren't, these kind of culture wars taking place on the radio as total war was taking place. And so this is why, you know, Linebarger really felt like if you wanted to study a country and understand it in order to craft messages for it, you had to spend a lot of time listening to the radio to see like what people enjoyed listening to and what would make them tune in. And that would help you to fine tune your own messages. And he encouraged students to study countries by picking one medium, and he encouraged them to pick radio, but they could also pick newspapers or movies, and just study them intently to learn about the culture. And he it's also why he felt like, you know, Radio Free America was such an incredible innovation for the United States, you know, that this was like a form of propaganda that was clean. You know, it was just advertising how great the United States was, you know, over the airwaves, allowing people all over the world to hear our music and hear about how great capitalism is and how our democracy was so awesome, and to get uncensored news. So he really wanted to fight psychological war through new technologies, and the radio was it.
One of the things that you write about that I thought was really interesting is the observation that the atomic bomb itself, while as a great weapon, it was also a fantastic psyop.
Yeah, it was something that didn't occur to me until I was deep into writing this, how much having a kinetic weapon is also a form of psychological aggression. And especially in the case of the atomic bomb, which was really intended after World War II mostly as a threat. One of the things that Linebarger points out in his work is that, you know, basically there's a few ingredients in a PSYOP. So if there's a message that's coming at you that's a PSYOP versus just, say, a regular political message, one of the big red flags for knowing if it's a PSYOP is if it contains violent threats. Anytime a political message contains violent threats, it is borrowing the language of PSYOPs. It's borrowing the strategy of PSYOPs. And there is nothing like having a nuclear bomb to lace almost any political message with an implicit violent threat. And that's what the Cold War was all about. The OG Cold War of the 50s and 60s, but also the kind of rejuvenated one that we went through in the 1980s, where every political speech about the greatness of America either explicitly referenced our arsenal or implicitly, you know, like, come over to our side because we have Levi's jeans and we have, you know, Steven Spielberg movies, but also we've got the bomb.
You know, one of the things I find fascinating about this, it's a work of a lot of history. Yet, as I read this history, I'm constantly immersed in the present day because there are so many parallels. And I'd like you to just talk about, like, researching this history and telling this story and presenting the story about stories as weapons in the midst of what is one of the most fiercest psyops and psychological wars that I've experienced in my lifetime.
Yeah. So this book started out as a history of psychological war. And I very quickly realized that what it really is a history of culture war, because our contemporary culture wars are very much modeled on techniques from more formal military psychological wars. And when we talk about psychological war and we talk about PSYOPs, there's a very specific definition. A PSYOP is something that is a message crafted by a military or some kind of state power in order to undermine the morale of an enemy, to induce them to surrender, to paint them in a negative light, to, you know, drum up, resistance to them. So that, and there's a whole set of, as I talk about in the book, a whole set of regulations around how you do PSYOPs within the military. There's boundaries on what kinds of messages you can send, and there's hard limits on the kinds of technologies you're going to have to deliver those messages. But during the Cold War, we saw a really rapid escalation of the use of PSYOP-like techniques in culture war. And I think it's because there was this weapons transfer program was happening because the U.S. government was starting to look inside for enemies. It turned away from the adversaries of the past, where, you know, adversaries were always foreign, and started to look at who were the adversaries within the United States. And certain groups came up again and again as scapegoats, as groups of people that were represented by the government and by politicians and powerful people as essentially the foreign adversary within. One of those groups is Black people, partly also immigrants, other people of color, but Black people come up again and again as this kind of internal enemy that must be contained. And we see a ton of rhetoric around that. And of course, again, it's no accident that during the 1950s, when we're seeing this culture war starting to build, that's also when the civil rights movement is building. And so these are people involved in civil rights movement are being portrayed by the government as anti-American, as, you know, communists, as people who must be stopped. And so the rhetoric about them is full of violent threats. It's full of lies, which is, of course, another technique of PSYOPs, is to kind of blend truth with lies to confuse people. But other groups that come up again and again are LGBT folks, especially today it's trans people, but in the 1950s, gay government workers were targeted during the so-called Lavender Scare, where, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people lost their jobs and, you know, had their lives blown up by being outed. And then, you know, other groups that tend to fall afoul of these kinds of government groups are feminists, and, you know, women trying to get ahead at work or create their own stories. So I talk a lot in the book about, this is kind of one of my favorite parts, actually. I talk about the culture bomb represented by Wonder Woman and how this, the story of this powerful woman who comes from a long historical tradition of powerful women, how that character became a way to talk about feminism. And, you know, we see in the 1950s and 60s, you know, government hearings about whether it is okay for kids, especially girls, to be exposed to things like Wonder Woman. Like, this rises to the level of like a national conversation. And in the same way that we've seen in the present day, groups like Moms for Liberty saying we shouldn't have any books that have LGBT characters or Black characters in libraries available to kids, right? So we had the same kinds of panic happening in the 50s and 60s during the Cold War about whether, you know, people should be allowed to learn about Wonder Woman. And indeed, you know, Wonder Woman began as an explicit propaganda project. The guy who invented the character, William Moulton Marston, with the help of his female partners, who also helped him conceive of this character, he said explicitly, this is propaganda for women's rights. And I want people to learn that women can be powerful, and stories are the way to do that. And he was a psychologist himself, so he was very interested in like using what he learned from psychology to promote a political position, and it worked. You know, it was very powerful. Wonder Woman continues to be a powerful symbol.
You suggest that in order to understand the information wars of the here and now, we need to understand the Indian Wars. And I thought that was a fascinating bit of history and a really great perspective that you bring to it.
Yeah, you know, and I think this is something that Indigenous folks have always known. And, you know, it's really, if we want to understand how PSYOPs and culture war work in the United States, we really have to view the 19th century wars between the U.S. government and Indigenous nations and tribes as kind of a formative experience, both for the U.S., but also for these Indigenous nations as well. And it's really the first, I mean, and this is a series of hundreds of wars with, you know, hundreds of nations, and it stretches over really a century or more, depending on how you look at it. But it's kind of a, it creates a lot of scripts that we're still following in this country around how to engage in warfare, but also how to engage in culture war. And there's a couple of things that really stand out from that period. One is that, you know, this is a moment when the U.S. government is using both kinetic war, you know, violent war, alongside cultural weapons. And so the kinetic war, it's obvious. They're going out, they're, you know, killing people, they're, you know, going to war with various tribes and nations. But then at the same time, the U.S. government, often under the auspices of the War Department, are setting up residential schools for Indigenous kids who are being forcibly removed from their families and put into schools where they're made to learn English, made to adhere to the rules of Christianity, and also learn Western farming techniques to kind of change their relationship to the land, because many of these kids are coming from cultures where farming is done really differently, or farming is only a small part of how they're creating resources. So this is the first brainwashing program. You know, it's funny because in the 1950s, the U.S. government starts freaking out about how, you know, American kids are being brainwashed by communists, and now we have the woke mind virus. But who invented that? The U.S. government in these residential schools really honed the technique of how to brainwash people. And of course, like all brainwashing, it's not a system that actually works. It definitely, you know, worked to rob a lot of kids of their culture and history and teach them English. But of course, Indigenous resistance to the U.S. government continued and continues to this day. And so that's the other really important part of thinking about these wars in the 19th century is how much it gave rise to a very American form of resistance to the U.S. government. Because remember, the U.S. government is fighting this culture war and they're fighting this kinetic war. And in the late 19th century, as the wars are getting more bloody and more violent in the West, you see the rise of a practice among the Plains tribes, especially in the Western tribes, of doing the ghost dance. This is a practice which involves singing, dancing, storytelling, and political action. So it's a combination of a cultural practice and a practice of political revolt. And a lot of the groups that are practicing the ghost dance, they're just, all they're doing is they're getting together and telling stories and celebrating the idea of white settlers leaving the land. And so the ghost dance is sort of a kind of futuristic tale of what does the land look like after white settlers leave and the bison come back and the old pathways come back. The railroads are gone. Industry, Western industry is gone to be replaced by Indigenous industry. And, you know, now we would call it in some ways, you know, Indigenous science fiction, because it really is about imagining an alternate future. And it's a very powerful, powerful message. It spreads really quickly among the Western nations. And the whole idea of the ghost dance is really demonized in the American media. A lot of laws, like local laws, kind of spring up to try to prevent Indigenous groups from practicing it. It's erroneously referred to as a war dance. That's not what it is. It's actually the opposite of a war dance. It's about imagining an end to the war, the wars. And so all this comes to the head in the, to a head in the 1890s when Sitting Bull, who is a great superstar in the nation. I mean, everyone knows who Sitting Bull is. He's this incredible general. He's respected both by American generals and by people within the Indigenous tribes that are kind of clustering around him and the nations that are there. And he's at what is now Standing Rock Reservation. And he's allowing his band to practice the ghost dance, and he refuses to stop. And he's shot by police because he's allowing people to engage in this peaceful dance. And because he's also refusing to obey government orders about where to live on his land and how to live on his land. And this becomes a kind of cause celeb, and it, you know, leads to a number of it leads to a wholesale slaughter of a number of people who are in his band, which again also becomes a huge scandal. And it leads to government hearings. It leads to a lot of attention being paid to how the ghost dance functions as resistance. And throughout the 20th century, you can see even in you know, white settler resistance movements, like say peace movements of the 1960s, you see people calling on imagery from the ghost dance. I mean, you see outright appropriation of Indigenous clothing and fashion, of course, among hippies in the 60s, but which is, you know, no one should be proud of that. But there's also genuine inspiration being drawn from this idea that political protest isn't just about screaming and waving signs or even taking up arms if necessary. It's also about telling stories. It's about singing and dancing and sharing a vision of the future that is different from the present and that carries forward traditions from the past. And that's such an American view of how conflict can play out. It's such an American view of culture war because it's a combination of culture, a combination of music and dance and politics. And that's how our government has always done it. It's always kind of combined cultural coercion with violence. And that's how resistance movements take shape here too. So That moment, the clash between the ghost dancers and U.S. forces, I think it's still being felt now, that that's still a major influence. And of course, Standing Rock continues to be this incredible political symbol.
You also describe Jim Crow as a psyop. And I thought, when you said that, when I read that, I just thought, wow, what a great way to retell the whole story so succinctly.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I didn't invent that idea. In fact, I got the idea for that from N.K. Jemisin, who's the awesome African American writer, who was actually, back when we had Twitter, was tweeting about the idea of white supremacy being a psyop. And Jemisin has a background as a psychologist, so she has thought a lot about how psychology kind of fits into storytelling and politics. And that struck me as just such a brilliant insight. And of course, many other people have talked about how Jim Crow had, profound psychological effects, traumatizing effects. And it also fits in, in terms of my narrative of how psyops kind of bleed into culture war. One of the ways that psyops work effectively is to create this idea that we're all fighting a foreign enemy. And we're fighting together against this foreign enemy. But when that enemy is within the United States, in fact, many Black people in the United States have family histories that go back much, much further than many white settlers. And in the United States, like they were brought over, 400 years ago or whatever. And so, how does the government and how do politicians try to frame these original inhabitants of the United States essentially as foreigners? Well, Jim Crow is a great way to do that. Set up a bunch of laws that force Black people through, say, redlining into living in only specific areas, that forces Black people to have access only to certain kinds of facilities, whether those are health facilities or bathrooms or roads or towns, basically to create a kind of internal nation of Black people who are second-class citizens under the law. And so it is perfectly legal to discriminate against them. And it's also a way of creating an image in white Americans' minds and other immigrant groups' minds that there is something foreign and other about Black people because we physically see them using other facilities or living in places where white people don't live. And so it's both, it's affecting the economic lives of Black people. It's affecting their political lives, but it's also creating this vast psychological gulf between white Americans and Black Americans. And so it was an incredible psyop. It worked really well. And the civil rights movement, civil rights movements throughout the 20th century, had to fight on two fronts. They had to fight for political power, but they also had to fight for cultural legitimacy. And that's why things like, historically Black universities are so important because they're about establishing cultural credibility for Black intellectuals, for Black people in power, showing that they are culturally just as advanced as white people. And it's also why, of course, Black culture is such a big part, Black pop culture is such a big part of Black politics, because, Black people are being marginalized both through these laws and through kind of psychological mechanisms, cultural mechanisms.
There has likely been more written about the 2016 election than actually happened. And I have to say, your history of that election is amazingly concise, really direct. It's beautifully boiled down. So, and it makes what, see, when one starts to think about it, it's just rapidly you enter a state of confusion, go, oh, what the heck? Whatever, we're past that. We aren't past the end. Your history of it makes that quite clear. Could you talk about creating that story out of such a mess.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that that I have even untangled the mess enough, because I think part of the story of that election was chaos. You know, a lot of the culture wars that were taking place during that time were not, they weren't culture wars as we think of them from the Cold War. Like in the Cold War, I think most people raised in the United States who like were exposed to, you know, American history books are like, okay, the Cold War, it was a fight between communism and American democracy and capitalism. And there were these two ideological camps and they were fighting each other over these very clear ideologies. But in 2016, what happened was, instead of an ideological conflict, we had a conflict between chaos and an attempt to have evidence-based reasoning, you know. So it was not, it was, you know, right-wing forces allied with, you know, Russian political operatives were not trying to spread a message of down with America. They were really trying to spread a message of, you can't even tell what America even stands for, because we don't even know who's saying what, and we don't know what these candidates stand for, and if they really are who they say they are, or if they're involved in like deep conspiracies around, you know, going to a pizza restaurant and keeping kids locked in the basement. And, you know, you get these conspiracy theories coming in that just, you know, aren't political. They're just aimed at undermining the political process entirely. So that was kind of the story that I wanted to tell in talking about how, you know, the firm Cambridge Analytica was intervening, trying to intervene in U.S. elections, and how, you know, Russian operatives like the IRA were trying to spread confusion on social media. Because, you know, if we're confused, we're also demoralized. So it is a great psyop. Like, confusion has always been part of that arsenal, is just to keep people paralyzed and unable to act because we don't know what's true.
Well, this was also really the breakdown of a consensus reality. I mean, when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, everybody, we all watched the same three networks. We all saw pretty much the same thing. And what we believed to be true was pretty much seemed to be what was going on, although the government had to let things in. But everybody, the beliefs of what the facts were similar across for most Americans. And I think what was successfully accomplished in the past 10 or 15 years was a complete annihilation of that consensus reality into everybody has their own facts and their own beliefs and you know, let fly what may.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would push back a little bit on the idea that we all had the same consensus reality in the 60s, because as I was talking about earlier with the ways that, you know, Black people have been marginalized in American culture and kind of excluded from pop culture, I think there were a lot of groups, including Black people, including immigrants and LGBT folks, who saw a really different reality 60s than that consensus reality that was presented on television and on the radio and movies. And so it's not so much that we lost that we lost hold of reality because we weren't all watching the same shows in 2016 or in, say, the teens generally. I think what happened is that I mean, two things happened. One is that I think that right-wing politicians successfully eroded our faith in the idea of consensus, you know, and kind of, and this is where culture war kind of overtook our public sphere. And there was a kind of valorization of warfare in general in politics, this idea that we're not doing politics unless we're fighting to the death, and that the point of politics is to fight and to win as opposed to reach consensus and negotiate. So the idea of achieving consensus was demonized. So I think that's part of it. It's not so much like that we weren't all watching TV. It was that we were watching TV and TV was saying, like, if someone's talking about consensus, they're a communist, or they're trying to pull something over on you, put something over on you. And so that was part of it. And then I think The other thing that happened was that, you know, our public sphere did shift away from these top-down kinds of media like television into social media. And it was very difficult to regulate political speech the way it is regulated on television. I mean, it's funny because when people talk about regulating political speech online, you hear a lot of, especially right-wing commentators saying, like, that's censorship. You know, that's like, you can't tell us what to say. And it's like, if you look at our laws governing television, governing political ads on television, it's highly regulated. You can't just, you know, air only right-wing political ads on a television network. You have to have, you know, have to make a good faith effort to represent all sides when it comes to political advertising on television. And that's accepted. That's part of our, you know, understanding of how television works under the First Amendment. These are exemptions. And so because we don't have that on social media, it was very easy for people to come in and say, well, first of all, we agree that consensus sucks. We don't want consensus because that's just for pussies. But also, and Democrats, but also we, you know, we have all of these ways that we can manipulate the public sphere and, you know, make it impossible for people to agree on how to establish truth, right? So we've thrown out consensus, and also we've kind of thrown out, you know, our ideas about what a truthful statement is and what evidence is. And then later this gets tied up in like mistrusting science during the pandemic. You know, all of these institutions and methods of reaching the truth, like using science or using consensus or using negotiation, those are gone. And, you know, again, I blame certainly political operatives for that. But also there's just a lot of, you know, what digital analysts will call coordinated inauthentic behavior. You know, there's a lot of groups online like the Russian propaganda group IRA, where their job, they're paid by, you know, a government organization or some other powerful organization to just post political opinions that they don't necessarily have, but just to give the illusion that many people share those opinions and to kind of seed the public sphere with divisiveness. And so, you know, we were just in a uniquely terrible situation in 2016 where political discourse had changed, but also the media landscape was changing in ways that were not regulated and which are still not regulated. We're still not sure how to regulate social media. I think we're getting closer for sure. And there's a lot of ideas about how maybe we should label posts, or maybe we should do fact checking, or maybe we should predict, like maybe we should warn people in advance about the kind of propaganda they might see in a technique called pre-bunking. But we're still at that moment, I would say. And that's the danger, right? Because we still haven't really figured out how to use social media for political debate.
Well, to me, reading your book, it seemed to me that what you describe early on as the fog of war has been recreated within the sphere of the entire culture. So nobody's sure about anything anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I start out the book by talking about the fog of war because it is one of the most traumatizing parts of being in a war, other than just the obvious sort of like violence and death, is that sense of not knowing what's happening. And, you know, the term the fog of war grows out of military doctrine, where commanders are talking about how do you make decisions in the quote fog of war. In other words, how do you make a decision with incomplete information? And there's tons of theories and treatises written on how you do that. But what everyone agrees on is that that's the most terrifying position to be in, is to not know. And so if you, and that is part of, like I said, part of the trauma of war. And so if you can create that fog in the public sphere, in a culture war, again, you can paralyze people. So when they go to the election, you know, when they go to the polling booth during an election, they don't feel like they can make a decision, or it's very hard for them to make a decision. And so And you know, that's when authoritarian politics become more popular because authoritarians promise to banish the fog if you just follow their instructions. You don't have to do any, you know, analysis of the political scene. You don't have to think about what other candidates are saying. Just do what the strong leader tells you, and the fog will go away.
You had a crash course in the PSYOP from somebody you called Han Solo, which sounds like a lot of fun if, you know, it escalated your alertness towards the terrifying place we're in. Talk about taking a crash course in PSYOP from someone who was well-versed in that aspect of life.
Yeah, so this is a guy who I did not use his real name. And he just kind of reminded me of Han Solo because he was just this kind of wisecracking guy who I had taught for many years at Fort Bragg, teaching special operations soldiers how to do PSYOPs. And so he had, you know, course materials for, you know, what soldiers are learning. And he gave me access to a declassified textbook that was aimed at, you know, junior members of you know, PSYOPs teams, teaching them how to build a PSYOP. And what really struck me about it, as we went through the lessons and talked about it, was that the military has almost completely appropriated the language of marketing to teach people how to build PSYOPs. You create a PSYOP product. That's the language that's used, is it's a product. People often workshop them. They do focus groups to see if the product is going to work. And they think about target audiences. Again, this is language borrowed from marketing and advertising. What is your product aimed at? Who's your target audience? And the reason they do this is partly because the field of PSYOPs itself does emerge at the same time as the field of marketing and public relations. And a lot of the people who are really foundational figures in public relations also did work in intelligence and in psychological operations. So there was a lot of cross-pollination between the two fields. The other reason why is because you know, PSYOPs are propaganda, and propaganda is stories and messages intended to change people's behavior. And just like advertising aims to tell you a story that will make you go buy something, or go enjoy a particular service, right? Or go vacation somewhere. So it's all about what kinds of messages will get you to change what you're doing, not just get you to sit on the couch for 2 hours, but like get you to go out and vote or go out and buy cereal, or buy bananas. And so that idea, it persists all the way into the present. It is often the case that when you see propaganda, it looks exactly like advertising and vice versa. And, you know, really good propaganda should be like a good ad, right? It should be really fun. It should be something you want to watch again and again. It should be catchy, stick in your head like a jingle. And then over time, convince you that, like, maybe you should come around to the American way of thinking, or maybe you should vote for Trump. And so that, I think, that was to me like an incredibly interesting thing to see, that there's no, the military is not making any effort to hide the fact that it's trying to teach its special operations soldiers how to advertise.
You do find rays of hope, and I think in the field of science fiction, adaptive science fiction, tell us about this.
Yeah, so you know, my instinct was, as I was working on this, that if stories can be weapons, that they can also be used to de-escalate war, and that they can be used in the service of ceasefires as well. And the aim of this book really is to be an anti-war book for culture wars. I'm not interested in, you know, how do we crush the enemy? I mean, obviously, if the enemy is coming for your throat with a knife, yes, you need to crush them. But in a culture war, it's often a much more diffuse kind of conflict. And so I was searching for ways to think about What does the public sphere look like when it's not a culture war anymore, when we're not using the metaphor of war to think about political will, to think about, you know, the future of our country? And so, you know, there's a lot of science fiction writers who are engaged in writing stories that do imagine a more peaceful public sphere. And there's different ways to do that. There's applied science fiction, which tries to take present day scenarios, whether those are military scenarios or technology scenarios, and kind of game out possible futures for them that are pro-social futures and encourage people to take inspiration from those, like encourage policymakers to take inspiration from those. And so I talked to Peter Singer, who does a lot of work with the intelligence community in futuristic scenarios and thinking about how to game out future peaceful scenarios as well as conflict. And I talked to a really interesting science fiction writer, Ruthanna Imrys, whose book, A Half-Built Garden, imagines a future version of social media, which is much more pro-social and focused around, you know, dealing with community emergencies, climate emergencies, other kinds of pressing community needs. Ruthanna Imrys is the pen name of a woman who also works in studying online propaganda. And so I thought it was really interesting that she actually, similar to Paul Linebarger, kind of divides her time between thinking about propaganda and thinking about possible futures. So she was a really interesting person to talk to. But I would say to finish that the one thing that ended up giving me the most hope as I was working on this was thinking about how the opposite of culture war, if there can be an opposite of culture war, is kind of the cultural piece represented by libraries and archives. And because I think one of the things we need is a metaphorical way of thinking about what should the public sphere feel like? Like, what does it feel like to negotiate and share information with other people without screaming at them? Because we need models, right? Like, we have things like Twitter turning into X. I mean, what would be the opposite? What would be X turning into Twitter, kind of? So the thing about libraries is that they're places of information without coercion. They're places where you can go to learn more about something guided by curiosity rather than being guided by ads or by algorithms that are, you know, trying to get you to engage emotionally as opposed to just kind of follow your whims. Librarians are not there to browbeat you into buying something or voting. They're just there to help you find a book about frogs, you know? Say you, like, I feel like we all have, you know, memories of being kids going to libraries and asking a librarian, like, for me personally, I asked the librarian, like, help me find books about science. And, you know, that's how I found science fiction, was through a librarian who was like, actually, well, there's these books about science, but also here's a whole shelf of books about, like, people in the future with spaceships and, you know, talking to animals. And it kind of set me on the path I'm on today. And so I talk in Stories or Weapons, I talked to a lot of librarians and archivists who are working in kind of non-traditional libraries, trying to preserve, for example, trying to preserve information about Indigenous tribes. Or there's a lot, especially now, there's a lot of Indigenous archives arising both in the United States and Australia and lots of other places where Indigenous groups have had their cultures erased. And of course, those cultures haven't been erased. And that's the point of those kinds of archives, is kind of preserving that history in order to let us go into the future, you know, armed with knowledge that comes from all kinds of different perspectives, not just the perspectives of you know, the U.S. government or white settlers, but, you know, everyone who chose to write about history, everyone who chose to write about the future. And so I guess the library is kind of a model of peaceful diversity, you know, information discovery that is self-guided, but also that it's a space where you know, there is a kind of gentle negotiation, a gentle harmonization that's happening in libraries where no type of speech is privileged over the other. And, you know, we meet there to learn things and teach each other things, not to win arguments. And so I think it's, if we can imagine a public sphere that is something like a library, I think that provides us with something to aim at. Like, what does it look like when the culture war is over? You know, it's hard to imagine that. But if you think of like a public space that's like a library where we're all just sharing ideas and you don't have to pick up the book, you know, like I can say to you, why don't you check this book out? And you're like, nah, I want to check this book out. That's a good public sphere where we have those choices, and we make information available to each other, and we do come to a consensus, because the consensus is everything belongs in the library. All of these viewpoints should be considered, and hopefully from there we're able to actually listen to each other instead of prioritizing yelling at each other, because we really need the freedom to listen as well as the freedom to speak.
Everything belongs in the library. I think that's a lovely sentiment. I've been speaking with Annalee Newitz. Their new book is Stories Are Weapons. Thank you for joining me, Annalee.
Thank you, as always, for having me on.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.